In April 2023, the United States and South Korea marked the 70th anniversary of an alliance that has served the strategic interests of both countries. Their relationship has expanded beyond security issues to include trade, technology, and other important policy areas. However, the alliance now faces challenges from changing notions of national interests and political polarization in both countries. On January 16, 2024, KEI hosted a discussion with Scott Snyder, author of The U.S.-Korea Alliance, Why It May Fail and Why It Must Not, on what domestic political developments in both countries mean for the future of the U.S.-Korea Alliance.
Good afternoon to everyone joining us today. In recent years, nationalism and political polarization have been increasing in the United States, South Korea, and other countries around the world. In his new book, The United States-South Korea Alliance, Why It May Fail and Why It Must Not, Scott Snyder at the Council on Foreign Relations explores these themes and how they impact the U.S.-Korea Alliance. For those who haven't had an opportunity to purchase the book, I would encourage you to do so. It's available online through Amazon or locally in the D.C. area, Politics and Prose, and I have a copy of it with me today. We're glad to have Scott here today to discuss these issues with us and their implications for future of the U.S. Alliance. We're also glad that Andrew Yeh from the Brookings Institution is able to join us as well. Their full bios are on our website, but Scott Snyder, as many of you know, is a senior fellow for Korea Studies and the director of the program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Andrew Yeh is a senior fellow and the SK Korea Foundation chair at the Brookings Institution's Center for East Asia Policy Studies. He's also a professor of politics at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. I'm delighted to have you both here today with us. For those of you watching on YouTube, we'll be taking questions at the end of our discussion today. Please place your questions in the YouTube chat function. So, Scott, I want to focus today's discussion on one of the key sections of your book, which is how domestic politics is impacting the U.S.-Korea Alliance. But before I do that, I want to start with the alliance itself. Last year, we marked the 70th anniversary of U.S.-Korea relations and the alliance. In your research, what factors have you found that helped to maintain the alliance over the last seven decades? And how does that compare with other alliances?
Okay, well, first, I want to thank KEI and thank you, Troy, for hosting this session today. And thank Andrew for providing some additional comments and perspective. As I look back at the 70 years of the alliance and think about where it has come from, the thing that really stands out to me is that the alliance has survived changes in the international security environment during those 70 years, as well as changes in South Korea's domestic political structure. As I did research for the book, I leaned on Stephen Walt's theory of factors that sustain alliances, and he talks about hegemonic leadership, the sustenance of the alliance as a symbol of credibility, the importance of institutionalization and ideological solidarity, among other issues. And so I would say that I see three factors that have made the U.S.-Korea Alliance enduring. One is the fact that the alliance is embedded in U.S.-led security architecture in Asia. And so it's not just a transactional alliance relationship. It also has a strategic purpose that goes beyond the needs of the particular moment. Another factor is the convergence of interests, especially in recent years around North Korea and China. And I think that that has given the alliance some momentum, especially over the course of the last few years. And really, a third factor was South Korea's transition from authoritarianism to democracy and its own economic development, which has helped to change the nature of the relationship from, you know, in its origins, more of a patron-client relationship to one in which South Korea's growing capacity has meant that South Korea brings something to the table And also shares the same values as the United States. It's really helped to make the relationship more equal and has helped to develop it into more of a partnership rather than something that is either more transactional or something that is less equal.
Now, Scott, in your or the subtitle of your book, you point out that, you know, the alliance may fail. So I guess my question to you would be is, in your research, what have you found that often leads to the dissolution of an alliance?
Yeah. Well, so as you suggest, I mean, Troy, the origin of my book really came as I thought about the relationship in particular in the context of developments in the prior administrations, the Moon and Trump administrations, you know, about basically internal threats to the alliance relationship. And as I thought about that issue, because, you know, we plan for external threats, but we actually don't really plan for any potential internal risks. And I started to look at some of the literature, and one theorist that crossed my desk was Alexander Lenoshka. And he talks about reasons for dissolution of alliances. He has five. The first two are pretty self-evident. If the alliance leads to victory or if the alliance leads to defeat, then there's no reason for the alliance to sustain itself. In addition, the marginalization of the alliance as a priority was a third factor. Interest divergence is a fourth factor that leads to alliance dissolution. And the fifth is transformation, or the embedding of a bilateral alliance into a broader multilateral structure. And so as I looked at those, the ones that I really thought were most relevant as risk factors for the U.S.-Korea relationship were related to divergence of interests and domestic political polarization.
So just to follow up on that, you know, how do you see our domestic, you know, our political interests diverging?
Well, it's really more of a risk factor than it is something that I think is an immediate concern. I actually think that at this moment, what we're seeing is a pretty pronounced convergence of interests between the U.S. and South Korea. But there have been moments in the recent past where we've seen debates over whether interest priorities are aligned with each other. And so I think that bears watching. If you were to ask me, you know, what is the real and present danger to the alliance relationship that I was really focusing on, it was really the combination of the increasing trend toward domestic political polarization in both countries and the emergence of forms of exclusive nationalism in the United States and South Korea. And that combination, I think, does pose a risk that we really haven't prepared to grapple with. And so that's the reason really why I tried to do this research and write the book.
So I want to expand a little bit on the U.S.-Korea alliance itself. And we've seen in the past, you know, perhaps in, you know, East Asia, outside of Japan and Australia, that U.S. alliances in Asia have gone dormant for periods, primarily due to, as you talked about, domestic political reasons. So what are some of the lessons we can draw from those experiences, either in places like, you know, the Philippines or Thailand, perhaps?
Yeah, and I touch on some of those cases in the Asian context where we've seen either domestic political polarization generate barriers to continued support for the alliance relationship. You mentioned the Philippines, I think, is probably the best known case study for that, where the Philippine legislature was not willing to support the continuation of the U.S. presence. And, you know, Andrew was resident in the Philippines for a while, so I'm sure he has more to say on that. And then in New Zealand, you had an administration that was anti-nuclear and did not want to have presence of U.S. nuclear submarines in New Zealand. And that led that alliance to become dormant. The other two factors or cases that I used were really related to interest divergence, and that involves the U.S.-Thailand relationship, which was more vibrant in the context of the Vietnam War, but has become kind of dormant. It's still named as one of our alliance priorities, but we see a constant churn in terms of coups and military leadership that I think has worn on that relationship. And then the other classic case of interest divergence is really the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, where U.S. made a decision to normalize relations with Beijing, and it resulted in the abandonment of the formal alliance relationship. But as you know, we have a lot of ties with Taiwan still, even despite that interest divergence.
So. Just, I do want to bring Andrew into this in a moment. And Andrew, if you have any thoughts on this as well, please go ahead and share them. But just beforehand, Scott, in the book, one of the things you notice is that the alliance is more critical than ever. Could you maybe elaborate on why you see that as being the case now?
Well, what I see is a deepening convergence of interest driven by the two main perceived threats that the alliance is grappling with in Northeast Asia, and that is North Korea and China. And so I think that what we saw through this last year during the 70th anniversary period was essentially efforts to work more closely than ever before and more in a more institutionalized fashion than ever before, precisely to deal in particular with those two challenges with North Korea. We saw the Washington Declaration, we saw the Nuclear Consultative Group, and the increasing institutionalization of our planning to include the nuclear dimension in dealing with North Korea. And with China, we see the alignment of the U.S. and South Korean governments. Interestingly, in particular, I think that the focus has been on the economic dimension of the relationship. South Korea's response to U.S. Export controls imposed on China in the high technology area, and efforts by South Korea to align itself with the U.S. And then more broadly, we see a lot of China-focused alliance cooperation that has developed, for instance, in the joint statements, both with Biden and Moon and with Biden and Yoon back in 21 and 22, and continuing on to the state visit.
And I think if you just look at the joint statements over the last few years, they've changed significantly, both in terms of scope and detail. There's been a lot of shifts in these directions. So, Andrew, one of the things... please go ahead.
Okay, so I was going to jump in right there. You were asking Scott about why the alliance is more critical than ever. Why is it important for U.S. and South Korean foreign policy? But before I do, I just want to say two things. First, thank you to you and KEI for organizing this event. I should say happy snow day, but it means that we can't meet in person, but I'm glad we can still do this virtually. Second, and I will get into this idea about the alliance being critical. If you look at Scott's title of the books, the U.S.-South Korea Alliance, so fairly straightforward, but then the subtitle, Why It May Fail and Why It Must Not. And, as Scott mentioned, we're just coming off the 70th anniversary of the U.S. Republic of Korea alliance. There's been all these celebrations. We've seen the Washington Declaration. Everything, the alliance just really seems to be gelling. It's at a point that it's really never been before. We've heard this from many experts. But yet the subtitle, again, is why it may fail. And so when I first looked at the subtitle, I was like, exaggerating things a bit and you kind of roll my eyes. But when you actually start reading the book, it's kind of a wake up call and a reminder of all the things that had happened in the past where there were tensions in the alliance. I had even done research on the alliance, in the early 2000s, and you quickly forget that there are actually possibilities where the alliance could fall apart. And I think the book is, of course, very timely because we're in a situation where domestic politics once again may there may be a disconnect or they may be at loggerheads between between Washington and Seoul. So for those reasons, I think the book is really timely. But to get back to this question about the importance of the alliance. For U.S. foreign policy, you know, 21st century problems can't be tackled by the United States alone. You can have a nativist American first policy, but still there are issues out there that the U.S. just cannot tackle alone, whether this means securing supply chain resilience for critical technologies or helping deter against a North Korean attack on the Korean Peninsula. You know, it's much better for the U.S. to have allies that can support American interests in Asia. And on the flip side, for South Korea, of course, the alliance is even more crucial and critical for South Korean national security because it's a smaller country. And Scott already mentioned, because of North Korea's growing nuclear and missile threats, these things have only increased. And Scott mentioned there's a part in Scott's book where he talks about nuclear extended deterrence. But as tensions become greater, you know, of course, South Korea is going to have to rely even more on the U.S. Now, some South Koreans are saying perhaps we need to do something else and maybe get our own nuclear weapons. But I think because of these security issues that are becoming more problematic, whether it's North Korea or whether it's China's position in the region, I think it's making the U.S.-South Korea alliance even more critical than ever in the 21st century.
Andrew, and I mean, you know, you're building on what Scott's been talking about. And, you know, I was reading as an op-ed this morning, it was talking about, you know, what was going to happen in the United States and everything going forward. And it talked about how a lot of people try to talk about, well, is the United States becoming isolationist? And they're like, basically, this author's thesis was, if you look at what either the Democratic or Republican Party is doing, there might be things that look that way, but ultimately there's still this desire to take and be involved, whether it's, you know, around recognizing the threat that China poses to the international order, whether it is what's going on at times in the Middle East. And that may come through each party in different ways. But ultimately, you know, it's more a debate between whether the United States is going to become more unilateralist or continue to work with its allies rather than really isolationist. And I don't know, I mean, Andrew, what are your thoughts on that? And Scott, is, you know, you've been looking at this sort of how that trend maybe will impact the alliance.
Sure. So Troy, those are, so first we should mention that those are ideal types. So isolationism on one hand or unilateralism, and then on the other end of the spectrum, the United States that fully engages in, you know, institutions, multilateral institutions and alliances. And so we'll probably never be on one extreme end of the spectrum or the other. But there is some talk that there's some pressure, particularly within the Republican Party, that the U.S. is moving towards a more of a nativist strand of foreign policy, which looks more isolationist, meaning that we're focused more inward on the U.S. The reasons for this may be slightly different among politicians, but the idea is that we're going to do less when it comes to the rest of the world, and we're going to focus on our own issues. And of course, this was reflective of, you know, President Donald Trump. I'd say I would refer to all of this as the restraint camp, meaning that we want a more restrained foreign policy. And so we are seeing some Republicans moving in this direction, some because they think that, you know, again, we should just focus on our own problems and we're just spending too much money, spending too much on wars, and let's just look inward. There are others, though, and just outside the Republican Party, some Democrats who have also subscribed this view, but for different reasons. You know, they feel that for their issues, they don't want to avoid, you know, the forever wars. They think that the U.S. has tended to adopt too muscular of a policy, or it's too militaristic. You know, they want to support peace and diplomacy, so they think that we can do less, and they want to focus more on domestic, you know, social welfare type problems in the United States. And so what this means is that you have this growing, I think, minority restraint strand in American foreign policy, which is, I think, led by some Republicans, but there are also some Democrats on the progressive end of the spectrum who have joined this cause as well, too. And so it makes for a strange bedfellows. You know, you have very conservative Republicans who want to do less. The Ukraine war is a good example where they're trying to block spending on Ukraine. For Democrats, there aren't very many Democrats that have adopted that view, but they certainly think that the U.S. can't just be spending or underwriting wars forever, and that we need to focus on diplomacy. And so you'll see those on the kind of the far left who want the U.S. to be more restrained when it comes to foreign policy. So I think that's a trend that we, I don't know if it's, it was growing, I think, with Biden in place, that's kind of been put to a stop or on hold because he's very much someone who wants to engage the rest of the world. But it may come back. We'll see if, you know, if President Trump comes back to the White House, you know, we may see that strand of foreign policy growing once again.
I appreciate the way that Andrew, you know, framed that. I think what I would add, maybe from a slightly different perspective, you know, has been, watching the growing calls for a retrenchment in U.S. foreign policy as a theme that one has to grapple with. And really, I'm thinking back to the Obama administration, where it essentially began to debate America's role in the world, but also what are American priorities. And then, you know, in the Trump administration, I think that where it really hit home for me was realizing that increasingly, if, for instance, President Trump says, well, if there's a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, it'll be over there. Well, that actually means that the assumptions that historically I hadn't had to necessarily justify, they require explanation in that environment. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was actually to try to not just take the alliance as an instrument at face value, but also go back and explain what its contributions have been and what it is contributing as a way of helping to understand, helping a broader public to understand that regardless of what is happening more broadly in terms of retrenchment, the U.S.-Korea alliance is an instrument that provides a value added and serves a strategic purpose, and therefore it needs to be prioritized as something that we need to keep in place. And so just broadly speaking against that backdrop, one of the purposes that of this book, from my perspective, was really to try to build that understanding and provide a defense for the relationship that we don't necessarily do if we simply jump to the point of, well, the alliance has been there for a long time, and therefore we kind of think that it's always going to be there. It may not be as durable as we think. There are threats that we need to be concerned about. And there is a purpose that it serves that, especially at this moment, responds to an increasingly convergent and mutual set of national interests.
So I think Andrew's point about retrenchment is right. And, you know, you just got about, you know, trying to determine which, you know, engagements we should be in is on point too. And I mean, we can even see this if we look at President Biden himself. When he was vice president, you know, he was probably the strongest voice for, you know, the U.S. withdrawing from Afghanistan. So you have, even within, you know, we're looking at Biden now as sort of the institutionalist, you know, this whole question of, you know, where should the U.S. be involved and how. And so I guess, you know, my question to you, Scott, would be, given that we're seeing more nationalism now, more political polarization, are there any specific trends that concern you? And, you know, we've focused a lot on the United States. You know, how do you see this playing out in South Korea?
Well, let me address the Korean side of the equation in particular, because I did spend some time on that. And really, you know, one of the things that was particularly striking to me as somebody who watches Korea closely is that, you know, I was well aware of the domestic political polarization going on in the United States, but really fascinating, especially in the context of the Moon administration, and he began with an initial address that was very positive in terms of trying to bring people together. You know, very shortly thereafter, we saw, in fact, the emergence of deeply held domestic political disputes and actual large-scale public demonstrations that were competing with each other simultaneously in different parts of Seoul. And I thought to myself, well, this is clearly a manifestation of deepening political polarization that can have an impact on the ability of both sides to be able to manage the relationship. And as I looked more closely at that, I found that there were certain foreign policy issues in South Korean domestic, in a South Korean domestic context that were particularly polarizing. And in particular, the North Korea issue and the Japan issue are the ones that really stand out as issues on which there are South Korean progressive and conservative camps that have diametrically opposed opinions. And so I think that where that becomes an issue really is that, you know, South Korea is not a large country, and certainly in its neighborhood, it suffers a relative power deficit with its neighbors. But, you know, what that means is that national unity becomes more important in terms of achieving national objectives. And so that's where I became a little bit concerned, is the effect of domestic political polarization on the capability of governments to be able to carry out their national security strategies, and in particular, how it would influence the ability of the U.S. and South Korea to cooperate with each other.
So, Scott, in the book, you talk about, you know, this sort of move towards focusing more on interests in the political polarization context, and, you know, use small F Korea first, you know, policies. And these, you know, America first policies and Korea first policies would seem to be at odds with each other, you know, just by its very nature. But is there a way, and I want to get your thoughts and also Andrew's, is there a way that, you know, if both countries start becoming more focused on policies that they see as explicitly in their interest as opposed to maybe the broader, you know, alliance interest, that they can still work together to take an advance common interests?
Well, my focus as I framed my inquiry for the book was really on how exclusive nationalism became an obstacle in terms of our ability to manage the alliance relationship effectively, precisely because by definition, what that means is that you're putting your own national interests at odds with your alliance partner and you're placing it as a priority. And so if we think about America first, I think the manifestations of that were transactionalism, in terms of the nature of the discussion, for instance, about burden sharing, in terms of financial support for the military presence, those kinds of things. On the South Korean side, I identified two strains of Korea first impulse that I could see as potentially emerging as threats to alliance cooperation. One was on the progressive side, what I referred to as North Korea first approaches, where the idea that working with North Korea trumps everything, including alliance cooperation. And the Moon administration did not pursue that policy, but it had senior officials inside the government who I think could rightly be identified as advocates of that kind of approach. And then, you know, on the conservative side, as we've seen in the beginning of the Yoon administration, the emergence of voices, especially around the issue of quote unquote nuclear sovereignty, of acquisition of South Korea's independent nuclear capability. You know, those voices come in a form that also represents a potential threat to alliance cooperation. And I think that that's one of the dilemmas on the conservative side, is how to work that out. But, you know, interestingly enough, there's a strand of thought on the left and on the right in Korea that I think can be fairly categorized as a Korea first impulse driven approach that could potentially become an obstacle to alliance cooperation.
Troy, let me just jump in here, because the irony in this question is that you have an America first and you have a Korea first, you know, sort of leaders. If in this hypothetical scenario, And you're asking if there are ways where they could actually work together to support joint interests. But the question is, would that be helpful for the alliance? Because they could still work together for a common interest. For instance, and this is just a hypothetical example. Scott mentioned the conservatives who are really pushing on nuclear sovereignty, that they want their own nuclear weapons. Let's say you have a America First policy where the US says, well, we don't want to guarantee extended deterrence for South Korea, or we'll let the Koreans fend for themselves. And so you say, we're disregarding nonproliferation for the moment. So kind of sideline that for the moment. And we'll just say the South Koreans, they should defend and protect themselves. That would be seen as a win-win, but would that be helpful for the alliance? Certainly not at all, because there would be real questions then about, certainly on the U.S. side, whether the South Koreans, you know, they clearly don't trust us, so they're going to go seek out their own nuclear weapons. But I do think there could be a case where, let's say the U.S., and it would require kind of careful rhetoric. You would have to kind of restrain how you phrase this, but let's say that the U.S. thinks that Korea needs to do more for the alliance, that they need to spend more, let's say, on alliance burden sharing. And on the Korean side, they say that, well, we want to do more, for instance, we want more autonomy. And so they want to increase spending, that they want to take on more of their burden for the security, but they want to say, let's say, have a reduction in U.S. forces. Then there might be ways where their interests may be mutual. But if they have close conversations over this, it may be actually helpful for the alliance in the long run. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should reduce U.S. troops. There would have to be a careful study of this. But Scott did mention that we shouldn't just reflexively assume that the alliance is always going to be there forever and it shouldn't change because it's something good for both the U.S. and South Korea. The circumstances are going to change, the environment's going to change, and so alliances need to adapt. I think that's why the U.S.-South Korea alliance has been alive and kicking for the last 70 years, because it's been flexible, because you have alliance managers that are willing to discuss issues over time and make those adjustments. So there may be another adjustment in the future. I think the problem with that, though, is that when you have America First, Korea First tendencies, it tends to be very nationalistic, and the rhetoric surrounding it becomes very unhelpful. And so really what you get is a destruction of the alliance. But it's not saying that you can't actually use those two advantages to put forward, have your interests align and keep the alliance intact. But I think that's going to be a hard task. So in Scott's book, he has this, political scientists love two by twos. He has this figure, but the bad quadrant, the worst, space in this two by two is when you have an America First and a Korea First policy. But that being said, there could be ways where some of the interests may still align.
No, I guess to follow up briefly, Andrew, it sort of sounds like even if there are areas to where you might have an alignment between some type of nationalistic America First, nationalistic Korea First policies, that the rhetoric within that context might actually narrow the scope of what alliance managers could do. So even in that sense, it could be more constricting in terms of being able to work together.
But I think the rhetoric and then kind of the narrative that comes out is important. I mean, the problem is, I think, let's say, again, in a hypothetical scenario, you have Trump in the White House and he wins 2024. But if you just think about his rhetoric during his first presidency, is things like the U.S.-South Korea alliance, they're free riders, they should increase their burden share by 500%. That he was basically disparaging the alliance. So if you're going to take that approach or tech, then there's very little room for adjustments. The Koreans are going to take that they'll be very upset, and vice versa too. If the Koreans were to speak in those terms about the United States, saying that we don't need the United States and it's more of a problem for our own security, the U.S. wouldn't take that lightly. We've seen that scenario before in the early 2000s, when there was a lot of anti-Americanism, and the U.S. governments of the Bush administration was looking at South Korea as a bunch, you know, comments were being made like they're a bunch of ingrates after all we've sacrificed for the alliance. So that space I think would become very, very narrow, I think.
Yeah, let me just also jump in and emphasize that I think there's a risk of interaction between America First and Korea First that could really spin out into a negative scenario. And so I'm thinking about how, in fact, the idea of a second Trump administration might actually give more running room to those who, because they're concerned about U.S. credibility, then want to pursue more actively a nuclear capability in ways that results in challenges for alliance management or that result in deterioration of the relationship. That, I think, is a more probable set of scenario that could develop than the scenario that both an America First and a Korea First leadership could successfully manage the alliance relationship. But at the same time, I don't necessarily want to imply that that type of leadership combination cannot manage the relationship. I just think that there's much greater risk to the relationship that would be involved in that configuration.
So speaking of risks and configurations, I mean, part of the configuration here is that within the alliance itself, there is an asymmetry in that, you know, the United States is significantly more important for South Korea's security than South Korea is for the United States security. So, you know, in this kind of context that we're talking about, you know, doesn't the U.S. president have potentially more room to maneuver than a South Korean president would, just given the structural asymmetry in terms of national security?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. In South Korea, you know, public opinion can cushion the effects of a Korea First policy that wouldn't undermine the alliance so much. So in South Korea, in one of my earlier books on anti-US based protests, I talk about something called a security consensus. And so within South Korea, you can you can criticize the alliance. Now it's a democracy, but you can only go so far. No political candidate, even a progressive candidate, is going to say we want a break with the alliance or we want to move away from the alliance. They'll talk about, you know, more autonomy or more independent foreign policy, but it's a taboo almost to say that you don't want that our future is no longer tied to the U.S. U.S. South Korea alliance. So in that sense, the Koreans Korean leaders are restricted in what they can actually say about the alliance. And again, it's because public opinion is also very, very supportive of the U.S. South Korea alliance, and they're also much more dependent of Koreans, that is, on the alliance, just being a smaller country. So that's the asymmetry. On the U.S. case, you know, it's you know, a U.S. leader could say that, well, Korea, you know, we're a great power, and we don't really need all these alliances. It's more constraining. We should just focus on our own interests. And so there is more latitude in some ways for a U.S. leader to disparage the alliance, treat alliances badly, and not go punished for it, at least not initially. So yes, I think there's more latitude for an American leader to have this nationalist, you know, America First type policy than vice versa on the Korea side.
So, Scott, one of the things that I actually thought was interesting in your book, and, you know, if you take a moment, this makes sense, but is that, you know, basically you argue that from a legal standpoint, the legal support for the alliance is actually very thin. And so in that broader context or the legal underpinning, how would you suggest that could you elaborate, I guess, a little bit on that? And how would you suggest that the legal architecture of the alliance could perhaps be strengthened?
Sure. I find it interesting that if we go back and look at the text of the Mutual Defense Treaty as it was written back in 1954, essentially both sides have a one-year advance opt-out provision. And so that means that the legal basis for the alliance relationship could end within 1 year of the determination by either leader to pursue that path. But over the course of the years, you know, we've become so institutionalized in terms of the closeness of the relationship and a lot of the customary aspects of interaction that, as a practical matter, I think that it would be very difficult to unwind the entire relationship in the course of a year and possibly even in the course of one administration on either the U.S. or South Korean side. And so that's just something to think about, as in particular, you know, drawing on the earlier discussion about, you know, what would actually happen in the context of the convergence of an America first and a Korea first leader. Well, I think that it would impose a lot of stress on the relationship, but I don't necessarily think that it would bring about the complete end of the relationship. It's possible that even any effort to deinstitutionalize the alliance relationship and to separate our security interests from each other would take longer than the term in office of either a U.S., a single U.S. or a single South Korean president.
So, Andrew, we've talked a lot about domestic politics today and how that sort of plays out of the alliance. And you know, one of the things that I want to touch base with you on this issue is, how do you see generational change playing into this in South Korea? You know, younger generations in South Korea tend to be, you know, pro-alliance and skeptical of North Korea. And so if North Korea is one of those fault lines within South Korean domestic politics, and even maybe in how the alliance is perceived by some of the people in the domestic political structure in South Korea, you know, is this something that, at least on the South Korean side, you know, over time could moderate? Or is this something that, you know, basically political polarization will take and start changing the views of younger generations too?
That's a great question, Troy, because the generational divide is not as straightforward as what we once thought it was. You know, maybe 15, you know, 20 years ago, we talked a lot about this 386 generation. So these are the Koreans who are, you know, college age students in the 80s, born in the 60s, and they were they're out in the streets protesting for, you know, South Korea's democratization, and they held progressive views. They tended to be more pro North Korea, and so they were more willing to protest against the U.S. They had even anti-U.S. views. So the assumption and the worry over time was that as this generation comes to formative age, which is now, that this would be a problem for the U.S.-South Korea alliance. But that hasn't really panned out. And now when we look at the younger generation, we're finding that, yes, they may support the Progressive Party. They're more likely to support Progressive Parties rather than the Conservative Party, which tends to push for greater South Korean foreign policy autonomy. But they're also concerned about North Korean threats, and they tend to be very supportive of the United States, U.S., South Korea alliance. So the cleavages aren't so clear cut. My own prediction is that I actually think it works better for the alliance, this younger generation, because of the threats. They've seen escalated threats with North Korea, and they're also very anti-China. That's something that we haven't talked about as much, but I think more than 80% of South Koreans across the board are, you know, have an unfavorable view of China, and this certainly is true of the younger generation. So all this would suggest that they would want to maintain their relationship with the United States. So I think in the past, we were concerned about the younger generation and what that would mean for the alliance. But these days, I feel more confident that actually having the younger generation, as they become aware of how important the U.S. United States is for their national security, that it would be actually helpful in the longer run for alliance politics overall.
Yeah, can I just jump in here? Andrew also reminds me with his reference to the situation previously. 20 years ago, the U.S. South, the role of the U.S. was actually very much subject to political polarization in South Korea in the context of anti-American demonstrations and the accident that killed the two schoolgirls. You know, it has been possible for, in the sphere of public opinion, for us to move from a polarization around the U.S.-Korea relationship to a relative consensus. And, you know, that's kind of interesting because that is a trend that actually goes at odds with the discussion of domestic political polarization that is going on, especially around the issues connected to Japan and North Korea. And so, you know, in some ways, that also serves the strong public support for the relationship, I think, serves as a buffer against the inclinations of either a possible America First or Korea First leader. It doesn't necessarily mean that the inclination to vote for a particular leader of that sort in South Korea would not be there, because I think that people are voting primarily on domestic issues. There still is public opinion at this point, still does serve as a little bit of a buffer against the worst impacts of that particular leadership configuration.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say it's a cushion. The political opinion forms a cushion. And so, as Scott mentioned, we could see a progressive South Korean leader in the future come back to office. But even if he or she would like to push, you know, for greater South Korean autonomy, I think they would have to think twice about, you know, pulling too far away from the lines, because much of the South Korean public will still think that the U.S.-South Korea alliance is crucial for their own country's national security.
Well, you know, this actually raises an interesting question for me, because we often talk about one of the strengths of democracies is that they're self-correcting. You can elect a leader, they implement policies, you decide those policies don't go well, and so therefore you elect someone with different policies, you know, when the next term comes up or next election. And, you know, Scott, you were talking about, you know, the political polarization in the early 2000s and what that meant for the alliance. And so, you know, I don't want to perhaps be too Pollyannish, but, you know, when we talk about some of these risks, you know, is this something to where perhaps because we are a democratic alliance, and maybe Scott, in your work, you saw something on this, that, you know, democratic alliances tend to be more self-correcting and are less likely perhaps to break down, or maybe, you know, maybe they're just as likely to break down. But I mean, sort of what have you seen on that self-correction within an alliance when you go through these different challenging periods?
Well, I do think that the 2003-2004 period was interesting precisely because the alliance became a focus of public opinion in a contested environment. And I actually think that that focus and that particular debate was the and also government efforts to try to respond to that, you know, are part of what has led to some extent, the compartmentalization of the alliance from domestic politics and the strong public support that has developed. I think some of the origins of that actually come from the lessons that were learned at that particular time. So I don't know if I would, it's hard for me to comment on the self-correcting aspect because, you know, at the same time, I'm thinking about the unprecedented challenges of penetration of disinformation that both that democracies around the world are facing in the current fragmented, in particular, media environment and social media environment. And there I have a lot less knowledge and also a lot less confidence at this stage about the ability of democracies to self-correct than I might have had 5 years ago.
So I have one last question for both of you before turning to the audience. And for those watching, again, please, if you have a question, put it in the YouTube chat function. But so we just had the Iowa caucuses last night. Former President Trump won. Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, finished second. And former governor Nikki Haley finished third, but only about a point behind DeSantis. Now, there is, looking at sort of polling and states going ahead,
perhaps a path, but a very narrow path for Nikki Haley to become the Republican nominee if she can either win or come very close to winning in New Hampshire. If, you know, I think we're all working with the assumption that, you know, this next presidential race will be Trump versus Biden. But if it's Trump versus Haley, and Haley in most polling is a stronger candidate against President Biden than former President Trump is, how would that impact U.S. foreign policy and some of the trends that we've seen? Like, how, I guess, how tied on the Republican side are they to former President Trump? Or is there a path forward if you have a different generation come to the fore in the Republican Party?
Well, I guess I'll start. I mean, I think that the really instructive aspect of the run-up to the Iowa caucuses for me was the fact that in the waning days, President Trump, he didn't find a nickname for Nikki Haley, but he did find an epithet. And the epithet was globalist. And so I think that that says a lot about what the Republican Party influence of President Trump has been. And it also says a lot about some of the challenges that somebody like Nikki Haley, who ironically cut her teeth, you know, her steep learning curve on foreign policy was as Trump's UN ambassador. But I think that she would have some really interesting terrain to navigate in terms of dealing with the Republican House leadership on issues like U.S. support for Ukraine and Israel. I think that in the debates, she made it clear where she stood on those issues. But I'm not sure that how she would manage to secure support from her own party to do some of the things that she seems inclined to do on the global front.
Yeah, I'll just add as well here that, you know, I think in some ways there would be more continuity with the Biden administration, that she is seen as more of a globalist, that she would want to sustain alliances, that she would want to, you know, work together with Europeans, with Asian allies. I think because she's from the Republican Party, though, she would be held accountable to some degree to ensure that other countries are doing their fair share. We may see debates about burden share come up again. She may ask allies to be contributing more. She may question some of the initiatives that are at the United Nations, even though, ironically, she was the UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador to United Nations. She might question, you know, the value of some multilateral institutions if she thinks that they're constraining U.S. ability to pursue its own policies and interests. When it comes to Korea, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, she had to face the fire and fury and the barrage of, you know, North Korean threats in 2017, and then, you know, of course, shifting gears to engagement in 2018. So she's seen the full gamut of what it's like to both have the most hostile relationship with North Korea and also engage. And so to me, that suggests that she may, there may be flexibility in her position. I think she would have, when it comes to dealing with North Korea, I think she would have more political flexibility or opportunity to, I think, try different things from the Biden administration. I know there's an argument about pushing this, you know, looking towards risk reduction and not emphasizing denuclearization so much up front. That's not necessarily a Republican thing, but I think she would be more open to different options. That's my guess.
So one question, and I want to move now to online, and I was actually emailed this question in advance of the event, deals with what Andrew's talking about, burden sharing. And there's reporting today, or within the last 24 hours at least, that the United States and South Korea may begin early talks on the special measures agreement. And clearly this is driven by the prospect of President Trump returning. But how do you see this playing out? And, you know, could this actually be a risk within the alliance itself? And, you know, Scott, ultimately, they may not finish in time. So do you end up just maybe pushing this to the front of Trump's agenda rather than removing it from his agenda?
Yeah, I think we can imagine that that could be a potential risk. I think that it is interesting that both the Biden administration and the Korean government seem interested in trying to grapple with this at an early stage. If we think at the, about the way the transition from Trump to Biden played out as related to the SMA, I mean, you know, basically what we had there was a stalemate in which South Korea had made its best offer, and then the Biden administration almost immediately accepted the best offer. This would flip that around, basically, from Biden to a possible Trump administration. And so I think that that would be one factor that one would have to think about as one concludes an SMA negotiation in advance of a new administration. One might not necessarily want to end up with the best offer if one is anticipating that in the context of a transition, the bar is going to be raised.
So I want to go to one of our online questions. In your book, Scott, it details a section on growing U.S.-China economic competition as a variable in the alliance. Given this, what do you make of the future of prior administration statements for China, China for the economy, United States security? I'm guessing this probably refers to the Trump administration. But more broadly, how does the, I guess, growing U.S.-China competition play into the alliance?
I think what has been really interesting under the Yoon administration has been the decision to abandon choice avoidance as the framework for South Korea grappling with Sino-U.S. rivalry and the abandonment of an attempt under the Moon administration to kind of be even-handed in dealing with the U.S. And China, respectively. I mean, the event that I remember was in the early Biden administration and with the Moon administration, you had the national security advisors of the U.S., Japan, and South Korea meeting, I think, in April of 2021 in Maryland at the same time that the South Korean foreign minister went to Xiamen in order to meet with his Chinese counterpart. And the Yoon administration has abandoned any pretense of trying to pursue choice avoidance. It's shown alignment with the U.S. It has, I think, embraced the cooperation with the U.S. on, in particular, in the technology sphere. We see the Korean private sector having shifted its new investment from China to the U.S. And so, you know, what that would look like going forward, I mean, the real problem, I think, that the Yoon administration is currently facing is that the China-South Korea relationship is in pretty bad shape because it's been hard for either side to gain positive traction in terms of trying to move the relationship forward. The Yoon administration abandoned the Moon's three no's, and it has been really hard, I think, for China and South Korea to find a new framework. Even the banner of mutual respect, when you get into the details, they haven't really been able to find a way to move the relationship forward. And so, you know, that's a challenge because it's actually also a political cudgel that the opposition can use against Yoon. The stagnancy of the China-South Korea relationship does have economic implications for South Korea, given proximity of the two economies. So there's a lot to dig into there. And a lot of that, it does revolve around the decisions that the Yoon administration has made to align more closely with the U.S. on China policy.
Yeah. Trey, can I just add something real quick there? I think Scott's right. I do think that last year, there was so much focus on the U.S. alliance, and we have seen the strengthened U.S.-South Korea relationship. I wouldn't be surprised if this year the Yoon government tries to engage, be a little bit more intentional and deliberate in trying to engage China further. It's not that they didn't want to engage China, but the relationship had soured to some extent. And you know, we saw the comment from the new he wasn't foreign minister then, but Cho Tae-ah, you know, there's this press interview where he talked about, you know, also needing to treat China as another great partner. It's not an alliance like the U.S., but it suggested that they were going to try to reach out to China. We know that President Yun tried to have a summit meeting with Xi Jinping, or a leaders meeting with him in San Francisco on the sidelines of the APEC meeting that didn't happen. Seoul's supposed to host the the China, Japan, Korea trilateral sometime this year. And I think they would like to make that happen. It would, of course, mean getting Beijing to agree to that. So I do think that it's much more complicated these days than just economics with China and security for the United States, especially with issues of economic security. But I do think that Korea will try to do more to reach out to China this year. At least that's my prediction for 2024.
Well, Scott, Andrew, thank you. This has been a great discussion. I think there's a lot more we could probably get into as well. But I appreciate you both taking the time, especially on this snowy day, to come online and do this. And again, for those of you who have had a chance, I would thoroughly recommend you get a copy of Scott's book, The United States-South Korea Alliance, Why It May Fail and Why It Must Not. Thank you both again.
Thanks a lot, Troy. And congratulations, Scott, on the book.
Thank you for listening. For more Korea content, keep an eye on our podcast feed.